This is Jeff Blankford with a March 15th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of each month and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. That schedule, as you can hear, is not etched in stone, since this happens to be the third Wednesday this month, the Ides of March, in fact, when you would ordinarily expect to hear Forthright Radio with host Joy LeClaire, with whom I occasionally switch dates, as we have this month. This means I'll be back with you again in my usual slot next week, as well as the following Wednesday, the fifth of the month, at which time I will duly open the phones to get your takes on the world, an event that seems popular with many listeners. In my opening news and commentary when I was last with you, that was back on February 22nd, I pointed out that it was the third anniversary of the U.S. orchestrated coup in Ukraine, the day that the country's elected President Viktor Yanukovych was forced to flee for his life from the capital Kiev after armed Ukrainian neo-Nazis had seized the initiative over the protest in Maidan Square. That moment in time, I pointed out, has been as effectively erased from history as it is being told in the United States, as has the efforts of the Democratic National Committee to undermine the chances of Senator Bernie Sanders to defeat the Democrats' anointed candidate, Hillary Clinton, for the party's presidential nomination. I spend a good time of my time, good part of my time, railing against those who can best be described as liberals, both individuals and organizations, that supported Clinton, who have been unceasing in their efforts to blame Russia, and particularly his president, Vladimir Putin, for defeat by Donald Trump. And my guest that day, Dutch journalist Carol van Wolfenen, also had much to say in the same vein on the subject. To make my points both about the U.S. role in Ukraine and the wrong-headedness of trying to pin Trump's victory on Putin, I played three sound clips. The first was of a secretly recorded conversation, probably by the Russians, between U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Victoria Nuland and U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine Jeff Pyatt about who should become the next prime minister of the country after the fall of Yanukovych that took place 2 weeks before it happened, and audio from a video of Senator Lindsey Graham and John McCain speaking to Ukrainian troops this past December, encouraging them to go on the offensive against Russia this year, and being and Dennis Kucinich, former congressman, a voice of sanity, being interviewed on Fox News, warning about the dangers of the growing anti-Russian hysteria. My hopes that it would go away, that I could focus on something else 3 weeks later, turned out to be unfounded. Situation has, in fact, grown worse, with MSNBC's Rachel Maddow, who I failed to include in my initial rogues gallery, playing the role of Senator Joe McCarthy in pushing the ongoing anti-Russian witch hunt. Whether this campaign by liberals such as Maddow, pushing what is essentially the neocons' agenda regarding Russia, is being done because they think it may be the only way to get rid of Putin, or reflects something deeper and darker on their part, is hard to know at this point. What is clear, however, is that it is reckless, it is dangerous, and without question, intellectually dishonest. It will be the subject of what I will be discussing later in the program with award-winning journalist Robert Perry of Consortium News, whose two articles over the last week and a half, The Politics Behind Russiagate and When Disinformation is Truth, published Monday, explores the problem. That will be 20 minutes past the hour, so stay tuned for that. The issue of intellectual dishonesty on this issue came to mind after coming across a reference to Victoria Nuland's conversation with Ambassador Pyatt about who should become the next Ukrainian prime minister as the pressure increased on Yanukovych, the one that I played for you, in a lengthy article in the March 6th New Yorker, written by its longtime editor David Resnick, Evan Osnos, and Joshua Yaffet. It was entitled Trump, Putin, and the New Cold War. Here's how the New Yorker literati described it. Quote, as tensions with Russia rose over the conflicts in Ukraine and Syria in early 2014, the U.S. was stung by a comment in Moscow politics, the weaponized leak. While the U.S. and the European Union discussed the details of a potential transitional government in Ukraine, an aide to the Russian deputy prime minister tweeted a reference to part of a wiretap conversation posted soon afterward to YouTube between Victoria Nuland, a U.S. Assistant Secretary of State, and her colleague Jeffrey Pyatt, the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine. Nuland is heard saying, F bleep the EU. Unquote, a line that the Russians knew would cause difficulties between the Americans and the EU counterparts. The State Department, said the New Yorker writers, called the leak a, quote, a new low in Russian tradecraft, end quote. Asked what form of penalty was extracted from Russia, Michael McFaul, the ambassador to Moscow during the Obama administration, said, quote, "To the best of my knowledge, there was none. I think that was a mistake," end quote. That was from The New Yorker. What the authors deliberately left out was the most significant part in which Nuland tells Pyatt who she wants to be Ukraine's prime minister, namely Arseniy Yatsenyuk, who they refer to as Yats, and that a popular Maidan protest activist, former world heavyweight champion Vitaly Klitschko, who they refer to as Klitsch, should stay out of it. In publishing a transcript of their conversation while Yanukovych was still in office, the BBC's Jonathan Marcus noted that, quote, "While the U.S. says that it is, quote, ultimately is up to the Ukrainian people to decide their future, this transcript," says Marcus, "suggests that the U.S. has a very clear idea about what the outcome should be and is striving to achieve these goals," end quote. Somehow this effort by Washington at generating regime change was not considered noteworthy by the New Yorker editor and his cohorts because it clearly contradicted the thrust of their article. And by the way, of course, Yatsenyuk got the job as prime minister. Well, if that's not intellectually dishonest, I don't know what is. In the meantime, neocon heavyweight, literally and figuratively, Robert Kagan, a co-founder of the Project for New American Century and husband of Victoria Nuland, broke his silence in a March 6th op-ed in the Washington Post entitled, "Republicans Are Becoming Russia's Accomplices." He says, quote, "It would have been impossible to imagine a year ago that the Republican Party leadership would be effectively serving as enablers of Russia's interference in this country's political system. Yet," says Kagan, "astonishingly, that is the role the Republican Party is playing. U.S. intelligence services," he points out, "have stated that the Russian government interfered with the 2016 presidential election with the intention of swinging it to one side. Knowing how cautious the intelligence community is in making such judgments, and given the significance of this particular finding, the evidence must be compelling." Except we haven't seen it. Anyway, "at the very least," writes Kagan, "any reasonable person would have to conclude that there is enough evidence to warrant a serious, wide-ranging, and open investigation." End quote. Well, Kagan is a man who is careful with his words. And notice, despite the fact that the intelligence agencies have presented the public with no evidence that the Russians interfere with the presidential elections, that sight and scene must be compelling, and thus, quote, "any reasonable person would have to conclude that serious, wide-ranging, and open investigation," end quote, is obligatory. Well, I guess I'm not a reasonable person because I see this entire story as pure propaganda designed to push a new Cold War that could very easily become a hot one under President Trump and his coterie of generals, pushed by American liberals and their war hawk buddies, Senators John McCain and Lindsey Graham. When considering the veracity of U.S. intelligence, it should be remembered that it was Kagan's PNAC that called for the overthrow of Saddam Hussein as the most pressing U.S. task in its founding document, that it was his fellow neocons, Richard Perle, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Michael Ledeen, and Scooter Libby, who produced the fake intelligence proving that Iraq possessed weapons of mass destruction and justifying the invasion of Iraq, for which, thanks to President Obama and the Democrats, they were never called to account. It was the same Kagan who served as a foreign policy advisor to both John McCain and Hillary Clinton. And it was her promise, Clinton's promise, to stand up to Russia and Putin that led to his early endorsement of her candidacy. Dear listeners, we have a very real problem when one cannot distinguish Michael Moore, Bill Moyers, Tom Friedman, Paul Krugman, or Rachel Maddow from Robert Kagan. Longtime political activist and former congressional candidate in our district, Norman Solomon, when asked to describe one long rant by Maddow, told his colleague David Swanson, quote, "Maddow's 25-minute soliloquy was a liberal version of Glenn Beck at the whiteboard. Her plot line was the current Democratic Party line, free associating facts, possible facts, dubious assertions, and pure speculation to arrive at conclusions that were based on little more than her zeal to portray Trump as a tool of the Kremlin. Even when sober," said Norman Solomon, "Joe McCarthy never did it better," end quote. We'll be delving into this subject at 20 minutes past with Robert Perry. The longest-running international farce, of course, is the so-called peace process, or pursuit of the peace process, designed to put an end to the Israel-Palestine conflict. If anything, it has become even more farcical under the Trump administration, characterized by Trump's appointment of his bankruptcy lawyer, an ultra-right-wing supporter of Israel, David Friedman, as an American ambassador to Israel, and his Orthodox Jewish son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as a person who, the president initially bragged, would bring the conflict to a successful end. Friedman's stated views about Jews who criticize Israel are so outrageous, he's compared them with those who collaborated with the Nazis, that his confirmation by the Senate is being opposed by leading Jewish organizations as well as by members of Congress. Friedman and Kushner have been strong supporters of some of the most right-wing Jewish settlements in the West Bank that Washington and the rest of the world consider illegal. One in particular, Beit El, built near the Palestinian city of Ramallah, has long been Friedman's favorite. Friedman, who has a home in Jerusalem, is the head of a charity, Friends of Beit El, one of the many U.S.-based Israel-directed front groups that were designed to funnel money to Israel and Israeli settlements without paying a dime of federal taxes. Friedman has reportedly raised and donated large amounts of money over the years to Beit El, estimated to be in the millions, while Trump's son-in-law Kushner has also sent quite a bit of money to the settlement, as apparently has Trump himself. In December, following the announcement of Friedman's nomination to be ambassador to Israel, Israeli radio reported that several years earlier, Trump sent a check for $10,000 to a dinner for Beit El, at which Friedman was the guest of honor. Yesterday, you may have heard on NPR that Jason Greenblatt, another longtime lawyer for Trump, who has been put in charge of the latest chapter in the farce by Trump, met with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in the West Bank. A day earlier, Greenblatt met with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for talks that reportedly touched on Israeli settlement construction. The State Department called this an orientation trip that was meant to hear from the two sides about returning to peace negotiations, as if anyone familiar with the conflict would take such meetings or even a statement announcing them without rolling one's eyes. NPR's Daniel Estrin reported from Jerusalem that, quote, Trump has asked Netanyahu to curb settlement building. Greenblatt said Trump also wants the Palestinians' economy and quality of life to improve. Trump's envoy, Estrin noted, is also meeting with the Palestinian Authority president amid a series of Palestinian street protests against the Palestinian leadership and its security ties to Israel. Palestinian riot police beat demonstrators and journalists at a weekend protest, he said. Well, that was from NPR, but there is much more to the story than what you will hear there or read in the mainstream media. First, Mahmoud Abbas's term in office as president of the Palestinian Authority expired in 2008 and was extended for 1 year by the Palestine Liberation Organization until the end of 2009, and after that indefinitely, although it is questionable what right the PLO, a largely moribund organization, has to do so. There has been no election since, and hence the position of president of the Palestinian Authority has arguably been left legally vacant for the past 8 years. Abbas is president only in the eyes of the United States, Israel, and countries doing business with Israel, because it is more convenient for Tel Aviv than dealing with the alternative, a genuine Palestinian leadership that would not agree to collaborate with Israel, as was spelled out in the Oslo Agreement, which Abbas himself negotiated and signed 23 years ago. The agreement stipulated that the Palestinian security forces' sole responsibility was to keep order among the Palestinians under Israeli occupation and to do whatever was necessary to quell opposition to the occupation, and it has faithfully done that. The Oslo Agreement also legitimized Israel's presence in 60% of the West Bank, what is commonly known as Area C, without any commitment on the part of Israel to end settlement construction or grant Palestinian statehood or independence at any time in the future. Signed with Yasser Arafat's approval and without the presence of a lawyer, Oslo represented the greatest betrayal of a people's struggle by its leadership in the post-World War II era, at the very least. Abbas has now been invited by President Trump to the White House, where he can be expected to shower words of praise for our new president worthy of the bootlicker he has come to be, while Palestinian Americans turn their heads away in embarrassment. Yesterday's NPR report spoke of protests against the Palestinian Authority while Trump's representative was paying a visit to Abbas. What actually occurred, according to someone on the scene, was that members of the Palestinian Authority militia, wielding heavy batons and shooting pepper spray and tear gas, attacked Palestinians protesting the murder of a Palestinian activist and the imprisonment of his five friends by Israeli forces and the Israeli court's decision to pursue charges against them for allegedly storing illegal weapons. The victim, Basil Al-Araj, 34, was a prominent Palestinian political philosopher who was killed by Israeli forces March 6th, 5 months after he was released from Palestinian custody, where he had been imprisoned for 6 months and allegedly tortured by Palestinian Authority intelligence. Palestinian Authority forces had arrested Basil and five of his friends in April of 2016, claiming that they had been in possession of weapons with plans to organize attack against Israel, though no official charges had been leveled against them by Israel or the Palestinian Authority. It should not be forgotten that as long as Israel belligerently occupies Palestinian territory under international law, the Oslo Agreement notwithstanding, Israeli soldiers are as legitimate targets of Palestinian resistance as were soldiers of the German Wehrmacht in Nazi-occupied Europe in World War II. That's something you're not likely to hear or said anywhere else. This is Jeff Blankfort. Thank you for listening.